This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia. Rodney Cohen is the Director of Multicultural Affairs at Presbyterian College in South Carolina. On September 5, 2008, he addressed the society on the subject of historically black colleges and universities.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to first of all thank Ms. Bailey Barfield for being a wonderful host and welcoming me here to UVA and the Jefferson Society, my new friend I met coming here, and also to an old friend, Mr. Paul Harper, president of the Jefferson Society. And also to the Jefferson Society, I would like to thank you for inviting me here. And it is indeed good to dwell in unity with you tonight here to talk about this very important and interesting subject that is dear to my heart, looking at black Greek letter organizations and society prior to 1900. The reason why I title it prior to 1900 is because there's relatively a gap in the research, historical research, relative to Greek letter organizations that predated the first black collegiate organization that was founded in America in 1906 at Cornell University by the name of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, which you all have a chapter here at UVA. However, when we look at the development of this organization along with the other African-American organizations that exists among the Divine Nine, there's a foundation that's very significant. And I think it's also very significant to look at being a member of the Jefferson Society as the oldest continuous literary society in America. And as we look at this history, we need to look at it in a very parallel way, because there was a lot of significant work going on in a very troubling and trying time for African Americans, when in fact many African Americans during this time were denied opportunities and denied legal rights, but somehow, some way found the way to organize in a very meaningful and significant way that not only benefited individuals but also groups of people, benefited communities, became advocates, became intellectuals, served as beneficial and mutual aid societies. Now, as we begin this conversation, one of the things we need to be real clear on is that since African Americans arrived in this country collectively, over 600 black organizations have been created in some form or fashion. Now, as we begin to look at Greek letter organization, and my new friend, Mr. Kozar, here and I had a great conversation on this at dinner tonight, we have names and nomenclature around Greek letter organizations, fraternities, societies. These names, although are similar, they take on very different functions. And I'm sure you all can agree tonight that the Jefferson Literary Society is quite different than some other societies throughout the country that call themselves literary societies. So with that, we look at the over 600 organizations that exist within the African-American community. Some took on the term associations, societies, fraternal groups, leagues, committees, parties, and what have you. All of these were different missions, different aims, and different goals. However, all serving a general community that was beneficial to a disenfranchised group of individuals. 1944, Arthur Schlesinger, which many of you all, I'm sure, are familiar with, talks about the paradoxical situation in this country as it relates to individuals in America joining organizations. And I know you all are familiar with his term of "we are a group of joiners as a nation of people generally." But Alex de Tocqueville, which I know you're familiar with, the 1830s, he talks about the dynamics between the wealthy and the powerful and the disenfranchised. Basically, how the wealthy and the power, based on their pure nature, has an infrastructure that is organized, a fraternal bond of sorts. So as a result, those who are disenfranchised have to come together in some form or fashion to organize against those powers that may be. Now, when we look at the sojourn of African Americans in this country, we know that around the 1600s or so, the 1500s, you had the development of the African slave trade. There's been some scholarship out there by individuals looking at secret societies that were transferred over from Africa, particularly the west coast of Africa. These societies or these organizations had rituals, had traditions, had induction ceremonies, had rites of passage and manhood training that were brought over to this country. So there was a propensity already early on for this type of activity amongst African-American individuals. Here, Carter G. Woodson talks about the arrival of Negroes in chains as a laboring class posed an interesting challenge to this country. A training of sort had to take place with this new transfer group of people. But the question was, what type of training would take place? Because if we provided a type of training that provided enlightenment, then we would have issues and problems around that. It will be contradictory to the system that we set up of chattel slavery or of enslaved Africans. I want to open the conversation up in terms of organized African-American fraternal organizations, again, starting as early as 1775 in this country. And this particular fraternal organizations that I'm going to talk about are known as the General Fraternal organizations, meaning that they were not collegiate-based. These organizations were individuals who, in some cases, were learned men in their own right. They were skilled men. They had trades, but they organized in a very significant way. The first organized fraternal organization for African-American men got its inception in 1775 as a result of this gentleman here, Prince Hall. Prince Hall, a native of Barbados, lived in Massachusetts. And Prince Hall, along with many African-American men during this particular time, was in a paradox because they saw the cry for freedom by those Europeans who were trying to remove themselves from the yoke and the tyranny of England, but yet they were being enslaved and they were being disenfranchised by the system that they were in. So Prince Hall, along with 14 other men, had the opportunity to engage individuals from Britain or the British troops, and they were inducted into a Masonic lodge, a military lodge. This took place in 1775. So Prince Hall, along with 14 other men, were inducted, and they created the African Lodge Number 1. And from that lodge, they began to organize throughout New England states. By 1776, these men then petitioned to get a dispensation from the Grand Lodge of England in 1776, which would somewhat legitimize them as true Freemasons in the United States of America. These individuals, under the leadership of Prince Hall, would go on early on to form schools, elementary schools, businesses. In fact, Prince Hall was a skilled laborer in the area of tanning leather and set up a business by the name of the Golden Fleece. Prince Hall Masonry helped to lay the foundation for another early organization in America named the Grand United Order of Odd Fellows, which was started in 1843. Now, the Grand United Order of Odd Fellows also, these gentlemen had to receive their dispensation or charter also for England. Now, this reminds me of an interesting piece of work done by Simon Sharma on Rough Crossings, where he talks about the dilemma between black Americans during this time of revolution in America of whether or not to serve and fight or try to defend America and the colonies or to fight and work on behalf or of the English tyrants. At this particular time, you saw African Americans fighting on both sides. What they noticed is that the English were more prone to accepting them, for whatever reason at that particular time, into these various organizations. Now, we were having a conversation tonight, and the conversation was, were these individuals trying to replicate some of the majority institutions that they found? Early on, most of these individuals wanted to become a part of established organizations that existed, such as the Freemasons, such as the Odd Fellows, such as the United Order of True Reformers, but they were denied by their American or colonial brothers at that particular time. So many of them, through their travels or through contact with English men, were accepted at that particular time and were able to then replicate those organizations early on under African or African-American context. William Brown, out of Virginia, started the Grand Fountain of the United Order of True Reformers in 1870. It was under his leadership that the first bank or saving trust bank organized by African Americans were developed by this organization. The Benevolent Order of the Elks in 1897, originally founded in Cincinnati by a gentleman who was able to gain access to a ritual of the White Elks by the name of Benjamin Franklin Howard. Now, I find it ironic because as I go through this research that I've been doing, I see a lot of names and a lot of dates that refer back to a lot of revolutionary leaders and independent leaders during the revolutionary movement. It's very significant with some of the names of the African Americans that started these organizations. Now, by the 1860s, we now get into the early collegiate movement of literary organizations and societies. One of the things I want to do is talk about the presence of African Americans in college early on. Now, in order to move from a general fraternal organization that I talked about that was not collegiate-based to a collegiate-based organization, we first have to talk about who was in college at this time. Now, we see that by the time the Jefferson Society came around, we only had 3 African-American collegiate graduates in the entire United States of America. By the 1860s, we began to see the development of historically black colleges. Close to the turn of the century, less than 2,500 African Americans were enrolled in any college or university, with the majority of those being enrolled in historically black colleges, such as Hampton Institute, Fisk University, Atlanta University, Talladega College, so forth and so on. 17% approximately of African Americans before the turn of the century enrolled at white colleges were principally enrolled in institutions in northern states. Some went to Canada, some went to Europe, Scotland, to receive education. This helps lay the foundation for what we know as the African American fraternity and sorority today. The exposure to northern institutions, the exposure to individuals and faculty who attended these institutions. By 1854, we see the development of our first African American college and university, Lincoln University. Now, earlier I mentioned the 1860s to the 1890s. All of our historically black colleges, with the exception of two, were founded in the 1860s, somewhere around 1864, 1865, 1868. But we had two institutions, Lincoln University in Pennsylvania and Wilberforce University in Ohio. It was Lincoln University and Wilberforce that started the literary movement amongst African-American college men initially. By 1865, up to about the 1870s, we began to see an initial explosion of literary societies amongst African-American men at these colleges. We started off at Lincoln with the Garnett Literary Society, named after Henry Highland Garnett, who was an anti-slavery advocate. Now, many of these early societies we're noticing would take the name of a prominent African-American or an abolitionist or a particular leader, and they would use those names as the name of that particular society. Later on, we would see the application of Greek letters. In 1867, for example, at Lincoln University, we see the development of the Philosophian Society. Here you see a slide at Atlanta University, and I pulled this from a 1904 bulletin. And this is one of the earliest examples of Greek letters in the African-American community being utilized at Atlanta University, the Phi Kappa Society. Prior to the development of this organization at Atlanta University, the Eureka Society, which was principally a debate organization but evolved into a literary society, existed at Atlanta University. Now, I want to tell you a story about the development of the literary societies at Atlanta University, for example. Early on, the colleges and universities in the South, such as Atlanta University and Fisk University, their faculty was principally made up of white professors from up north. And many of these professors, due to their experience at northern universities, wanted to transplant the idea of a literary society for the purpose of developing the intellectual acuity of their students down to the southern African-American institutions. This was very revolutionary because many of the northern philanthropists that studied, that funded these institutions, were not in accord with this type of activity. In fact, they wanted to maintain the puritanical teachings and education of producing a docile group of individuals at this particular time. They felt that the introduction to high-level literature, debate, elocution, and this type of thing would provide a class of individuals that would be a clash and contradictory to the status quo that had been developed in the country at that particular time. So as these organizations began to morph, they began to take on a significant life of their own, to the point that students became very involved in these organizations and actually led these organizations and began to develop organizations on their own. In 1877 at Atlanta University, the Eureka Society was developed principally by individuals from the college group. And also, they brought in individuals from the preparatory college, which were not really full-fledged college students at that particular time. As that group began to morph and evolve, then we began to see splinter groups break off from that. And we saw this same example at Howard, Fisk, Atlanta, and Talladega College as well. As we move to the late 1890s, we begin to see the development of female literary societies. Now, we talked earlier tonight about the paradox between African Americans developing unique societies based on exclusion from majority white societies. But what we began to see happen is some of these cultural deficiencies were now being replicated by these organizations that were set up at African American colleges. You begin to see intracultural discrimination going on. So now you begin to develop rival groups at the college, some based on color, some based on hair texture, some based on lineage, some based on socioeconomics. This is in the early 1900s and late 1800s. We begin to see this phenomenon take place. Sexism as well. So as a result, we began to see now African-American women express their voice early on and developing these literary societies to express their voice and create an avenue for expression. This is an example of one of the early literary societies not far from here in Petersburg College, at what you know now as Virginia State University, which at that time was known as Virginia Normal and Collegiate Institute in 1896. Kappa Gamma Chi, another one of the early Greek societies at Virginia State, was an all-male literary society which openly discriminated against women at that particular time, which helped to stimulate the formation of the early group that I mentioned. Now I want to get to Fisk University, which is Paul Harper's beloved institution. Now, one of the things I really want to point out is very critical in this talk is that you're going to see a recurring number of HBCUs talked about. Before probably the 1920s, we had about 250 historically black colleges on record. As the time went on, those numbers began to dwindle down to now we have about 103. However, you had a very select group of historically black colleges that were very different than others because they had a liberal arts slant to them. These institutions were preferred or preferred by certain philanthropists, certain leaders, because of the education that they were trying to promote to their students, versus the agricultural colleges such as Hampton Institute and Tuskegee Institute that was started by Booker T. Washington in Alabama. Up until about the 1880s or the 1890s, the literary societies picked up a significant amount of steam at these institutions. They filled a void that was not only intellectual, but that was also social. These literary societies at these institutions provided biweekly social gatherings, debates, lectures, and what have you. By the time the late 1880s rolled around, these institutions began to notice the evolution of athletics at historically black colleges. This provided a challenge for the literary society. The first sport to be introduced was baseball at the historically black college, and it provided a challenge, at least from a social outlet, that they dominated or monopolized before the onslaught of athletics at these institutions. It was not until about the 1890s that football really began to take hold at historically black colleges. By this time, the first wave of literary societies began to almost go into extinction because the interest of students now began to shift to this new sport known as football. Now, this was critical because many of these literary societies would hold their functions on Saturdays, for example, which was really the major social event at the college. In fact, it was so major that it will rival today any athletic event. There's accounts and primary documents that talks about hundreds and hundreds of people, in some case thousands of people, coming out to these literary gatherings or debates that was established, and it rivaled a football game between two schools. So they began to now move into competition with this newfound athletic development at these institutions. One of the reasons it was so important is because as athletics moved into the pantheon of HBCUs, it struck an interesting chord throughout Black America. I put this image up here because, and we have a friend in the back here from Oxford, Ohio, you would have African Americans who were in certain communities where sports did not exist, and they would travel to other communities to participate in sporting activities. So they were always looking for these various organized outlooks. In fact, in this picture here, what you see is a combined effort of students from Atlanta traveling all the way to Ohio with students from Ohio to participate in the off-season of the school and athletic events, because they were denied opportunity to participate in certain athletic events in their particular community. As we move to the turn of the century, we now see a new social order developing within the African-American community. These organizations that was once open, they once invited the campus community, had open functions and social, now began to go underground. Now we begin to see our first introduction of secret societies within African-American institutions. George Towns, who was a graduate of Atlanta University in 1894 and classmate of James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the lyrics to the Negro National Anthem, also known as Lift Every Voice and Sing, moved up to Boston to do graduate work at MIT and Harvard. His experience there of intellectual organizations prompted him, when he came back to AU as a faculty member, to start up a new form of organizations that really tapped into a higher level of intellectual discourse, primarily amongst the men of that particular campus. When he came back to Atlanta University, he developed an organization known as the Owls of AU. After a while, maybe 10 years, Professor Towns disassociated himself with the Owls because the organization began to take on a secret orientation. It began to discriminate based on color. And it also began to discriminate at the institution based on social economics as well. After George Towns removed himself as advisor from this organization, the Owls continued on for about another 10 or 15 years. What happened with this organization is a rival organization began to crop up at Atlanta University named the Wolves. And the Wolves were comprised of individuals at AU who were of a darker hue, who were not of the same socioeconomic status, and it created a significant rift within the institutions. Now, at this particular time, administrators throughout African-American institutions began to notice the rise of these secret organizations, and they had significant issues with it, to the point that within the catalogs of many of these colleges and universities, they explicitly point out that secret societies are not allowed at the institution. So in order to circumvent this attack by administrators, many of these secret organizations would conduct business and conduct their activities off campus in homes of individuals throughout the community, in different Masonic lodges, and other buildings and facilities throughout the college campus. Now, by the time the turn of the century hits, we now see the development or the formation of Greek letter organizations as we know them today. Beginning around 1903, we see the first development of this at the college level that now takes on the complexity and the context of the Greek fraternity as we know it. In 1903, at Indiana University, this is one of the earliest documented organizations, Alpha Kappa Nu, an organization utilizing Greek letters for the fundamental purpose originally of social bonding and organization in a fraternal context. This organization was very short-lived and did not really lay any significant roots to move on and pretty much extinguished after about 2 or 3 years at Indiana University. Delta Phi Pi is an organization that I'm currently really investigating that started in the early 1900s as well. This is an image of 1904, but this was a primarily honor society, but began to morph also into a Greek letter fraternity as we know it today. This organization had a lifespan maybe of about 10 years and began to fizzle out around 1914. In 1904-05 at Cornell University, this is where we get the roots and antecedents of the first collegiate African-American fraternity that was developed in the United States of America. However, the organization started out in 04 and 05 as a literary society. And it was principally based around what was going on in New York and in Canada at that time, which was the Niagara Movement, which was brought together by W.E.B. Du Bois and other African-American leaders at that time to talk about the issues of discrimination in Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. So these individuals took the works of Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk in 1903, and began to have discussions around this and began to coalesce around this particular subject. In the year of 05-06, the organization then moved to a social studies club. And by 1906, developed into a fraternity. Now, this created a significant split within the organization because you had a number of individuals, most prominently C.C. Poindexter, who was one of the older members of the group and a more mature member. In fact, he was a graduate student there. He did not agree with the organization moving from a literary society and going into a fraternity. He thought it would bring about frivolity. He thought that they didn't have enough knowledge about Greek culture to move this to a Greek letter fraternity. 1904, two years prior to the first undergraduate African-American fraternity, we saw the development of a professional Greek letter fraternity in 1904, Sigma Pi Phi, that was founded in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by a man named Minton, along with three other colleagues. And this was an organization of professional African-American men who found themselves isolated in Philadelphia, but they were all professional men. Now, they began to also develop a debate whether or not they should bring in collegiate men, because they wanted this to be an organization of professional African-American men, principally physicians, dentists, businessmen, attorneys. So there was a temporary experiment of sort to bring in a couple of undergraduates at this particular time. They decided to initiate a couple of college students in the area who were at Penn and one at one of the local medical colleges. And mysteriously or ironically, both of these individuals died shortly after that, and they discontinued the idea shortly after that happened. I want to point out Wilberforce University. I mentioned earlier about Lincoln University. It was founded in 1854. Wilberforce University was also founded in 1854, which is one of the oldest HBCUs as well. We see that Beta Kappa Sigma was one of the earlier Greek letter organizations as well. Now, what is interesting about this group is, and we saw this a lot, is that early on, many individuals who toyed with the idea of fraternity would later go on to help establish the foundation for the Greek letter fraternities that established themselves in a more solid way later on. I want to point out to you in this picture, the second man here to the left by the name of Charles Young. Charles Young was the third African-American graduate from West Point in 1889. After graduating West Point and being in New York, he came to Wilberforce, which is in Ohio, to become professor of military science at that institution. He was a decorated veteran in the Spanish-American War, but he would go on to be initiated in the Omega Psi Phi fraternity and become a major player in that organization. So what we began to see is a lot of cross-pollination that took place with the early experiments of brotherhood that really began to take place later on in other organizations. Alpha Phi Alpha, founded in December 4th, 1906. For whatever reason, versus these other organizations, they were able to create a Greek explosion that took place between the years of 1907 and 1914. Henry Arthur Callis, who was a young man at Cornell University at the time, explains very vividly why they thought that the fraternity was needed more so than a social studies club, and why this fraternal idea that they created had to be transported throughout the United States of America. They thought that the conditions that they were living in at that time, that this fraternal bond was vital and essential to their survival. So by 1907, these young men at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, began to take this idea and package it and take it throughout the country, which laid the foundation for Greek life in America. In 1907, two of these young men from Cornell University took time out to travel throughout the East Coast and began to spread the gospel of this fraternity to other young men throughout. As soon as this fraternity was founded, the word spread throughout. In fact, we have letters and documents from at least five or six universities in Canada where African Americans were being educated, who were sending petitions and letters to start a chapter there. So the very next chapter that was started in December 1907, exactly a year after the fraternity was founded at Cornell, was at Howard University. Now, this is very critical because if they had gone to any other institution, this experiment in brotherhood might not have taken root and grown. Howard, unlike the other institutions, Lincoln, Wilberforce, Howard was considered the capstone of Negro education. It was the largest, it was the most equipped of the African American universities. It was a federal institution. It was in the nation's capital. It had not only the personality, the wherewithal, but it also had the human capital to now develop a stronghold of this fraternal movement. This is a picture of that first group of individuals at Howard University, Beta Chapter, that was started in 1907 at Howard University. Now, this is where we begin to see the development and the explosion take place. When that next chapter of the fraternity Alpha Phi Alpha was founded in 1907, it was not until 1911 that the next two fraternities were founded. However, between that particular time, we had 10 significant chapters that were developed at some of your most prestigious institutions in the country. Now, these individuals were very shrewd in their mind. Some would say elitist in terms of where they decided to establish chapters. In addition to receiving petitions from institutions all over the country, some in Canada, they also received a significant number of petitions from African-American institutions, historical black colleges. However, they were very particular and said, we would not accept any petition if the institution is not considered a grade A institution. At that particular time, you only had four or five HBCUs who were considered grade A. Howard was one of them. Fisk was another. Atlanta University was another. However, when you're talking about the Southern historically black colleges, that puritanical attitude that existed from the administration wanted to create and maintain a stranglehold, and they were frightened by the secret societies that they had experienced early on in the 1900s and did not want these fraternities at their institution. So that's why it's no mistake when you look at the development of these early chapters here before 1911, the last one going up to Ohio State in 1910, they were all at majority institutions with the exception of the first two, Howard and Virginia Union. Virginia Union was an exception because one of the original members of this fraternity that was founded at Cornell actually started off as a student at Virginia Union. Kappa Alpha Psi, which was the second fraternity, African-American fraternity, founded in January 11. Now, remember I told you there was an organization in 1903 at Indiana University by the name of Alpha Kappa Nu. That is not to be confused with the next organization that was founded, Kappa Alpha Psi, that coincidentally happened to be at Indiana University as well, even though some argue that, but they are wrong in that argument. There's no real connection between the two there other than the similarity of the names that I'll get into. Again, now this points to the fact of how significant Howard University is in the development of the African-American tradition. We talked earlier about Miami University of Ohio and how so many fraternities were founded there, and it's called the Mother of Fraternities. And that could be also the fact for Howard University. And I argue and have argued before that even though Alpha Phi Alpha, for example, was founded at Cornell University, it was really the nurturing environment and the intellectual human capital that existed at Howard University that was able to take this seed and really grow it into the organization that we knew and the influence that it had. These two individuals here, Byron K. Armstrong and Elder Watson Diggs, took the movement and the idea of fraternity to Indiana University in 1910. They were originally students at Howard University in D.C. One of the students, one of these young men, had a cousin that attended Indiana University and was persuaded to transfer to Indiana University, and thus his friend followed him to IU. They say in their documents and spell out that their idea of fraternity was sparked by the fraternal activity, primarily from Beta Chapter at that time, that they saw at Howard University. So going to Indiana University and seeing the similar conditions that existed as a young man at Cornell University, they thought a brilliant idea, which it was, to start an organization for African-American men and the African-American community for them to coalesce around the idea of fraternity. 1911, a year after these two young men ventured to Indiana University, they founded Kappa Alpha Nu. Similar to Alpha Kappa Nu, We believe that they borrowed the name from that, moved it around, and based on that tradition, adopted Kappa Alpha Nu. By November of 1911, you're going to correct me on this, Paul. By November 1911, the third African-American fraternity was founded at Howard University as well, Omega Psi Phi Fraternity. Now, I talked earlier about the competition between some of these organizations. And it's funny because when I look at the development of the Owls and the Wolves at Atlanta University in 1902 and 1903, it reminds me of some of the debate and the competition that took place at Howard University around 1910 and 1911. It's documented that young men at Howard, Elder Watson Diggs mentioned this, that the fraternity that was founded or established in 1907 at Howard, Alpha Phi Alpha, during its development there up to this point, began to develop a caste system. They began to say that the majority of these men were of a lighter hue, were from a certain lineage, and it was very discriminatory. So as a result, you now saw the development of a rival organization at Howard University. At this particular time, prior to 1911, the only organization fraternity-wise that existed at Howard was Alpha Phi Alpha. The second organization was a sorority by the name of Alpha Kappa Alpha in 1908. So this organization developed in 1911 and gained the distinction as being the first African-American fraternity founded at a historically black college. In 1914, a few years later, that same claim that was made by the group in 1911 was made again by this group in 1914, that we wanted to start an organization, quote, that is not based on hair texture, color, or social status. So we began to see that not only were African Americans dealing with issues from the broader society of race and racism, but they began to deal with issues from an intracultural discriminatory pattern as well, based on color, status, hair texture, and so forth. Now, I want to go back to Kappa Alpha Nu. 1911, and this is very critical here, of what I just said about that paradoxical dynamic between dealing with the majority society and dealing with one's own race and discriminatory patterns. Back at IU now, we're dealing with the broader society. Kappa Alpha Nu, who had the letters K-A-N, reached an interesting point in their history. There was a young man on the track team at Indiana University, as you see here. And the founder of Kappa Alpha Nu, Elder Watson Diggs, had the opportunity to go to some of these track meets, and he observed very derogatory terms and slurs being thrown at one of the members of his fraternity as a spin on the letters Kappa Alpha Nu. In fact, in the Indiana University newspaper, they began to now call the organization Kappa Alpha Nig, I-N-G, in quotes. It was at this point that Elder Watson Diggs, along with some other members of the organization, said that we need to reevaluate based on this social dynamic, and they changed the name of the organization in 1915 to Kappa Alpha Psi. So once again, we see how the external pressures and the social and racial dynamics helped to influence the development, at least in nomenclature, of this organization. It's very important to understand that as these organizations were developing in the very infant stage, in the very critical stage of their development, there were darts being thrown at these organizations from all areas. I like this image here because many of you all might know who this individual is here. You see that they were juxtaposed to an image of the Ku Klux Klan at this particular time, yet these individuals continue to remain steadfast in their development. Now, real quickly, I just want to mention, without taking up too much more time, and I want to field some questions, the development of African-American sororities, which took on a different slant, slightly different slant than African-American fraternities. Ethel Helgeman Lyle is credited with really starting the sorority movement for African-American women in America. She was a close confidant to a young lady who was on the administration and faculty at Howard University who had spent some time at Brown University. We believe she was mulatto, maybe octoroon, quadroon, and had infiltrated some aspects, some sororities up there in organizations, but never joined. And as a result of that exposure, came to Howard and began to influence some of the young ladies there to organize, if nothing else, around a social context. Now, Ethel Hedgman, who was the girlfriend of George Lyle, who at that time was president of Beta Chapter, the fraternity at Howard, she began to observe what that organizational structure did for those cohort of men and suggested that she start a similar organization. So she was able to move forward and develop the first African-American sorority in 1908 at Howard by the name of Alpha Kappa Alpha, which recently celebrated its 100-year anniversary. Now, by 1912, 1913, there was a social movement around women's suffrage. Again, this paradoxical type of dynamic that existed. So as these African-American women were organizing mostly around social issues and social camaraderie at Howard University, you had a group of women at this time say, we need to be addressing really the social issues of the day at Howard University. Quote, most of our activities do not need to revolve around tea and social gatherings. So in 1912, 1913, you had a group of young ladies who were members of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. And as a result of wanting to change the mission of the organization, wanting to change the colors of the organization, change the motto and the thrust of the organization, moved to start another sorority. Now, what's critical about this is at this time, Alpha Kappa Alpha was not incorporated. So the entire, basically, chapter at that particular time agreed to make this move at Howard University. The saving grace was Ethel Hedgman Lyle, who was still in the city, and others who came back to now incorporate the organization, but these young ladies still decided to break off because their issue at that particular time was women's suffrage. But they also ran into an interesting dynamic because as they were fighting for these rights, they were also fighting for the right to start an organization that was not welcomed by their own sisters in the same organization. And they all also denied the opportunity to participate in the women's suffrage movement as equals at that particular time. As I close up, I want to also highlight the last group of organizations that were developed in the pantheon of African-American fraternities and sororities. And the next to come into existence was Zeta Phi Beta sorority at Howard University as well in 1920. And the last sorority to be developed was in 1922 at Butler University by the name of Sigma Gamma Rho. Now, up until recently, there were 8 recognized fraternities, 4 fraternities and 4 sororities as comprising the elite 8. But recently, there was another one added to that collection of organizations, which brought the total to 9 organizations known as the Divine Nine. By 1922 up to the 1960s, you began to have other sprinklings of experiments of fraternities that came, developed, and fizzled out. Probably the next wave of the development of any significant fraternities was in the 1960s during the Black Power movement. During this particular time, you had organizations such as groove phi groove, iota phi theta, which again began to ask the question of the relevance of these organizations that predated them. Going into that Black Power movement, they thought that these organizations were too European in structure, too European in philosophy, and did not address the needs of the students or the community at that particular time. So as those organizations developed, they began to challenge the question of the existence of those fraternities and sororities. Now, today, I would say, as I close out, the biggest struggle and challenge, as we were talking this evening, is how do these organizations view themselves in today's social and political context while reviewing the rich history and tradition and intellectual legacy and cultural legacy that predated them. That is a major struggle that many of these organizations, particularly at the undergraduate level, are struggling with. And I think by investigating the history and having a serious conversation around the tradition of these organizations, then we can now bring back into focus the relevance of the African-American fraternity and sorority as it once was. Thank you. Well, that's a great question. It was threatening to the establishment. It was not until the 1950s, primarily, that many of these African-American colleges got their first African-American administrators. So you're talking about from the 1860s to the 1950s that the lion's share of administrators and board of trustee members and philanthropists were whites, principally northern whites, who wanted to be benevolent but yet were threatened by any organization or any kind of intellectual train of thought that might be contradictory or counter to a social order that they wanted to maintain. Even providing higher education, they still wanted to maintain a particular order. It was very obvious with your agricultural institutions like Hampton, Tuskegee, Virginia Normal and Collegiate, Alcorn State, Alabama A&M, Tennessee A&I, you know, these institutions. It was not that evident or obvious with your liberal arts colleges because you were dealing with things that were quote-unquote considered enlightening, but the administration was very puritanical in that regard. As I mentioned earlier, when we look at the early development of these organizations, principally, it was not until about the 1920s that African-American organizations were even allowed to enter the campus as Southern Black colleges. Now, this was a little different at the Northern institution. So your older African-American chapters existed at your Wilberforces, your Lincolns, your Howards, which were only three or four institutions north of the Mason-Dixon line. But down south, in fact, Du Bois was very critical of this because he was a member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated and was initiated in 1909 at the University of Michigan and was an advocate of what they were promoting and would go back to Fisk and give lectures and talks and critique them but not allowing. So the desire was there, the need was there, but they were afraid of these organizations bubbling up and maybe creating some other type of angst that you know might exist as a result of those groups. Yeah. Well, you saw the instance that I mentioned in terms of Kappa Alpha Nu, for example. Principally at the majority institutions, you saw this. So that's why it was very, first of all, number one, even without the institutions, you had people who were threatened because it was only a few African Americans in many of these institutions. As I pointed out, you know, prior to the turn of the century, you only had 2,500 African Americans in college. So those 15 or 17% of African Americans who were matriculating in majority institutions were few and far between. In fact, Alpha Phi Alpha that was founded at Cornell, if it had not been for the African-American institution, it would have gone extinct at Cornell, because there were long stints of time where you never had another African-American male on the campus. And a lot of that had to do with the social climate and this type of thing. And in fact, they point to the fact that in the early 1900s, if it had not been for this organization that linked up and developed a coalition with people in the community, the African-American community of Ithaca, New York, they would not have survived, you know. So yes, there were threats from the students, from the community, and it's no different than, you know, some of your early students, for example, at West Point. But with this organization, they were able to coalesce around each other and serve as a support mechanism. So that's a very good point, because I think we were talking about that this evening. The development of an African-American fraternity, in this case, at an Indiana university, for example, is very different than at a Howard University, because that's not the issues that they're dealing with. So the issues at a Howard or a Fisk became light skin versus dark skin. You see? So now you begin to have an intracultural discrimination, that pedagogy of the oppressed, that you begin to adopt now, you know, the ideology of your oppressor, and now you're promoting this on the individuals at the institution. So, but now that's a good question. And in fact, it affected, you know, the name, like I said, Kappa Alpha Nu, because you know, this was actually printed in the student newspaper. I do have a copy of it, where in the student newspaper they say, "We now have a new organization on campus, Kappa Alpha Nig, based on the letters K-N." So for 5 years, 4 or 5 years, this was the name of their organization. Even though it's not explicit, I would assume that they borrowed this name, obviously, from the organization that predated them in 1903. But after a while, they had to change it and change it to Kappa Alpha Psi. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good question. In fact, just recently, we had the first white member of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity to pass away. He was a Jewish student, in fact, and was a dentist, and came into the fraternity in the 1940s. Well, first of all, there's a couple of things going on. Early on in the development of these organizations, you wouldn't have had a white student who even wanted to become a part of these institutions. Now, I want to juxtapose this to HBCUs to make this point. Historically, black colleges, from their inception, have never discriminated. In fact, Hampton Institute, for example, was known for early on having a significant program in Indian Affairs, where they had Indian students, Native American students, who were matriculating at Hampton Institute. So these schools never discriminated. In fact, Atlanta University, that I pointed out early, and Fisk were lambasted by these northern philanthropists we talked about early on, because they were the only institutions, and when I mean institutions, I mean colleges, universities, or anything else that brought people together that was integrated in the 1800s. This was novel, because you even had the sons and daughters of the white northern faculty who were there, who enrolled their students at Atlanta University at Fisk. They ate together. I mean, this was unheard of in the 1800s and the early 1900s. But to answer your question more specifically, that was not an issue until about the 1940s, where you began to have individuals, like I just mentioned, who came in closer contact with African-American students, may have, in fact, developed an affinity and wanted to join. Again, you begin to replicate ideas and ideologies sometimes of your oppressors. So there was a backlash from a lot of individuals as they began to integrate, and the reason why is not from necessarily a discriminatory point, But the idea was, now we finally have something we can call our own. And now you have what may be considered an infiltration, you know. So you began to see a little bit of integration around the 40s, 50s, but nothing of any major significance. So these organizations officially in the 1950s on the books began to explicitly put in that they don't discriminate, even though they didn't formally discriminate. However, certain language that was used, for example, the history book of Alpha Phi Alpha is dedicated to the Negro youth who marched onward and upward toward light. That was taken out in the 1950s or 60s, you see, to in their language begin to open it up. But you never had a mass influx of any other basically racial groups of students coming in there. Yeah. That's the million-dollar question. And what I mean by that is that now you are now seeing a development of significant literature around this subject, scholarly works to really look at the issues and the social dynamics, because now you see an internal critique going on. Because when you look at the history and the legacy of a lot of these organizations, unlike the Jefferson Society, for example, or the Phi Kappas in Georgia, and I can go on and on and on and on, unfortunately, at African-American institutions, for whatever reason, and we talked about some of the reasons in terms of the competition, and you had that competition at UVA and other institutions, but these organizations, meaning these literary societies, were unable to maintain a stronghold up to today. So the kind of things that you all, for example, the Jefferson Society, bring to the table and raise certain issues that maybe Kappa Alpha wouldn't do, or any other fraternity may not do, these institutions were robbed of that. So what you had happen is these fraternities now had to do a lot of dual roles, even though they did start off with an intellectual tradition. That's the struggle that's going on now, and that is the question that is being asked even by the leadership. Because what we find now is due to the lack of eldership, due to the lack of an insular environment, these questions now are becoming very prominent. Not only is it the African-American fraternity and sorority, it's the African-American community as well, you see, because when you live in a segregated society, certain cultural norms and mores that exist don't necessarily exist anymore when you go into an integrated society. So if you talk to some older African-Americans, they'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to black folk was integration. Now, of course, that can't necessarily be the worst thing because we don't want to go back to the time period, but if you understand the spirit and the context of a social order that existed, that has been destroyed to a certain degree, you see, whereas organizations like this or University of Virginia, it started off from the beginning as a freestanding organization and institution, where these organizations grew up out of the bowels of discrimination and that type of thing. So that's a very excellent question, because now that these barriers don't exist, you know, how do you position and posture yourself as an organization now? Now you have to battle and fight with popular culture that's so popular now in terms of influence in these organizations. It's very difficult to pull a tradition up to the future today. So that's a serious subject that is going on today, because one of the major issues that faces these institutions is hazing, which faces most fraternities and sororities, but is very prominent amongst a lot of these organizations. But the history and tradition is still rich, so that's a great question, and that's being wrangled with now. You know, people are struggling with that. Right. I'm glad my good friend Nick is here, and even Paul, because we've had these conversations before. And one of the things that I failed to point out is that if you look in early annuals, like Howard, Virginia Union, and this goes back to your question, about the secrecy of it. In the early 1900s, at Howard, for example, when they would have the shield or the crest of the fraternity in there, they would not show the pictures of the members. Okay, so during that time period, they were still borrowing from that secret society era. To get to your question, as we move through each era of development, these organizations began to replicate a lot of what was going on. So even people asked that about the pledging as we know it in African-American fraternities, lining up, dressing alike, shaving your head, and all of these different hyper-masculine type of images and activities that go on. By the time African-Americans went to war in World War II, and it was the 1920s that we saw a significant increase of African-Americans beginning to go to college, okay? So as they were going into World War I and coming into the military, we now start seeing this militaristic type of thing creeping into the fraternity. By the time we got to World War II, and definitely by the time we got to Vietnam, it took it to another high. So in the 1960s is really when the stepping culture, as you know it, really creeped in. And a lot of that had to do with the Motown era of how people expressed themselves through the steps and everything of the entertainers that they saw. So they began to replicate these syncopated steps and different things. Now, prior to that, they always grouped, lined up, and sang, but by the 1960s, with the Temptation and the Motown era, they literally began to replicate that. So from that point up to now, it's just morphed and evolved into an entity of its own. But the unfortunate part is that sometimes that becomes the more of a focus than some of the other things that take place as far as the rituals and the tradition, the heritage, or the intellectual tradition, the heritage that you talked about. And I'm glad Paul brought that point up because in lieu of other intellectual outlets, these organizations developed periodicals that were very intellectual in their thrust. The first one, in fact, the Sphinx Magazine, which is the official organ of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, is the second oldest African-American publication in the country behind the crisis, 1914. And they regularly had the leading scholars and intellectuals publishing in this magazine and bringing up certain issues on that. So about the 1960s is when that took place. Right. That's an excellent point. And this goes back to the conversation we were having about whether or not African-American fraternities exactly replicated, replicated European organizations to the T. And in the context of developing an organizational structure based on examples that were out there, they moved to identify and express their Africanness in some form or fashion. Case in point was the Masonic Lodge that started in 1775, 76. They started off by calling themselves African Lodge number one. They were real clear on who they were and what they were, which after getting the dispensation became African Lodge number 459. As these organizations began to develop, they had one foot in European and Greco-Roman culture, but they had another foot also in African culture and began to wrangle around that and debate that issue as well. So you begin to see different images like the Sphinx, for example, trying to build on not only the ancient Kemetic culture of civilization, but also Ethiopian culture, which they talk about very specifically in their development, or the African violet for Delta Sigma Theta. So even though they had a lot of European influences from America, they were real clear on the fact that we wanted to introduce, as much as we knew at that particular time, African-American culture or African culture into our organization. Reconstruction. Well, before Reconstruction, you already had development of some fraternal movements. What Reconstruction helped do is help solidify some of the movements that was going on, particularly in benevolent organization of mutual aid societies. In lieu of structured organizations such as insurance companies, banks, Reconstruction helped open up opportunities for now these organizations to manifest themselves in a business context. Okay? So now you have like the grand true reformers who set up your first African-American banks in the 1890s and was able to now distribute funds and loans and provide mutual aid benefits to African-Americans as a result of Reconstruction opening up some things there. So that infrastructure that was laid down early on was able to manifest itself more prominently during that particular time.